with that drum roll, we are prepared to bring you another live edition of American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM from Garden City, New York. I'm Tom Ryan, Heidi Morales Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host here as well.
I am.
For the Friday edition. We do this
sans
every Wednesday.
Cans.
And Friday, sans cans. Sometimes with them. Every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6 p.m. Fridays, we call it How Music Changed. To sum this up really quickly, what we do with How Music Changed is we've made a list of 250 of what we consider to be the most important compartmentalizations of what happened in the history of recorded music. We arranged them all chronologically from the turn of the 20th century, going all the way back to like literally the early 1890s when we started, and right on up to the present. We've done an awful lot of the really early series. We are probably right around 1930 or so now when we go to the Wayback Machine. But we've also jumped up for half of our shows. And it's really technically, it's much more than half of them. Because when we do the more contemporary stuff, we tend to do much more shows. For our own sake and for the sake of our listeners. For example, if we're going to do a show on, say, Bing Crosby.
Let's face it, the newer stuff probably has more recordings made.
Much more, right. So if we go to something that is very, very early, when we covered New Orleans jazz, I think we maybe got in three or four shows on early New Orleans jazz.
But a lot of those guys were afraid to record, so what can you do?
Right. Nobody Bolden recordings. But when you get up to the contemporary stuff, you're going to say you're going to cover a band like, say, the Beatles or Motown, well, that's going to require 60 shows. Because it's a genuine contemporary interest in it. So that's more or less like the weight of it. And we are on a series dedicated to Stax Records. And this is show number 25 dedicated to that label, which was so incredibly important in the mid to late 60s and existed on into 1975, which is near where we are getting. This is show number 25.
So
and this
close.
Covers most of the music from the year 1973. What happens with this, though, when you do a lot of shows for something like this, I'm beginning to notice that there's an arc. You could call it almost like the American Hit Network arc or the How Music Changed arc. When you're doing a history of something, it starts out as nothing. It builds up to something absolutely incredible. And then you get the downfall.
It starts to peter out.
Well, you get where things begin to turn. And this show is where that turn becomes quite obvious. On all fronts, unfortunately. My summary for this show is this that I wrote up. This is, if you go to our website to hear any of our shows, because every one of them is posted at AmericanHitNetwork.com. If you're interested, you can see the entire Stax series, all 24 shows, this one being 25 to follow it. And I have text for all of them. I wrote this about this show in particular because it kind of sums it up. When Al Bell sealed his distribution deal with Clive Davis of Columbia Records, he unwittingly also sealed the fate of Stax Records. At first, it seemed like a perfect marriage where Stax needed to get its product into territories that had previously been resistant, and Columbia would get recognition for finally having some credible product for the R&B market. Once Clive Davis was summarily dismissed from his position as president of Columbia Records, though, the entire deal unraveled. Most of the agreement was based on verbal understandings between the two principals. So once Davis was gone, there was nobody left to execute his promises.
Oops.
With increasing debt and government investigations regarding payola scandals happening simultaneously, Stax went into a downward spiral that pointed toward the inevitable. It certainly did not help that they could not generate any significant hits during this time period, as can be seen by the songs featured in this show. It's not to say we are hitless, but we are not going to find anything of the caliber of, say, a Sam and Dave or an Otis Redding hit when the label was at its peak and growing and growing and growing.
Oh boy.
We are now moving in a very significantly different direction, unfortunately. We will start, though, with a song that seemed to have a lot of potential. The songwriters loved this song when they wrote it. They knew it was going to be perfect for the Staple Singers. And they couldn't wait to bring it to the band because they knew that every single time Mavis opens up her mouth on anything that they wrote for her before, they could see gold.
Mm.
She just brought so much to the table. The thing is, when they brought this song, Pops loved it so much that Pops said, "Ooh, you know what? I'm going to sing that one."
Wow.
And the songwriters, as they said, they could more or less see their $1 million in sales just sort of vanishing, because they figured, like, oh, Lord, no. You know, this Pops doesn't have the same sort of appeal that Mavis did with the pop market.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it may not,
may
not have been a gold record, but it still managed to sell 100,000 copies, and you got to love Pops. He was able to sing it because it didn't require somebody with the intensity of Mavis. This track is called Be What You Are.
Listen. I love it when Pop sings.
Yeah, it's great.
Always did.
So soulful.
He's got a great deep soul. He doesn't have to over-emote, but he makes his point perfectly. And I got to say, it's really impossible to miss the irony of the message of that song. I mean, based on what the Staples are saying in the lyrics of that song, it's too bad that they weren't running the accounting department for Stax Records. The song's all about being sure that you live within your means. Don't spend beyond what. Don't try to be something that you're not.
That's right.
Be happy what you are. You know, be who you are and live your life.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful message, and really one that was sitting right there under the noses of the people running the label. Even the bank that was responsible for what was happening was overextending themselves. Check this out. Again, I'm reading directly from the book called Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion, written by Robert Gordon. Really great book. It's been absolutely indispensable to me doing this series. Union Planters National Bank was not in the music business, but it had become one of Stax's closest associates. We had a great relationship with Union Planters, says Al Bell. Matter of fact, we would keep $1 million on deposit in a checking account just to provide additional funds for the bank instead of putting in a certificate of deposit. It was just that kind of working relationship. The cash on hand must have been very helpful, assuming that the bank noticed, but they were a disorganized, improperly administered institution.
Oops.
Union Planters got very, very sloppy in its lending controls at the high, wide, and handsome age of the early 70s, says Wynn Smith, an attorney who retained by the bank. Their problems extended from several areas, all of which might have been prevented by better oversight within the bank. In 1971, the bank expanded heavily into real estate loans, though it did little preparation or research. Nor did it monitor how its new clients actually dispersed its funds. Further, says Attorney Smith, Union Planters had a project in the early 70s called Your Signature is Your Collateral.
Oh, boy.
And they started going crazy making installment loans on automobiles. It was so easy to get a loan that people were coming from all over the country to buy very expensive Cadillacs, and then taking off with the Cadillacs and not paying the installment loans. These are the people that are in charge of helping to be the conservative end of what's happening at Stax. We'll get back to that more in a second, but I want to play this track by an artist named Stefan, one of the few white artists that were releasing singles at the label at this time. But he's funky enough, I think. Some people think he sounds a bit like Leon Russell. I think I might be pushing it because I'm a big Leon fan, but nevertheless, it's a fairly interesting track. It's called I've Got to Love Somebody's Baby.
Well, I got to love somebody's baby, 'cause somebody's been living bad. Everybody around me knew it, but I was in the dark for a long time. I've got to get what she's been giving, get myself together and start living. I've got to hold somebody's baby, 'cause somebody's been holding back. And lately, when I try to squeeze her, she says maybe later. Right now, I don't have the time. It's not an hour for that, but I need a little luck. Now I'm looking out for number one. Wait a minute, I don't know where I went wrong, darling. a big house and telephone, a washing machine and fine car. Now I don't know half the time where you are, but let me tell you what's good for number two, it's good for number one. If you're gonna keep on being on true, I can play that same old game too. I've got to love.
It's an artist named Stefan, or Stefan, S-T-E-F-A-N, regardless, which is interesting because in a way you do hear like a less gravelly Joe Cocker, as if he's backed by, say, some of Leanne Russell's shelter people, that sort of a thing. It's got that feel to it.
Maybe he was a shelter person.
Unfortunately, he never really went anywhere. In fact, what was happening, this is rather interesting, Duck Dunn, the bass player, who was kind of not doing much at this point in time because he was really disgusted with the state of Stax himself, barely even deciding it's hardly even worth showing up on some days. But he liked this guy, Stefan, and he had an idea by talking with the guitar player, Bobby Manuel, about maybe putting a band together to go out on the road to back him up.
Oh, that would be more fun than
Doing nothing.
Yeah, than hanging out with a bunch of disgruntled people.
Right. So they were gearing up to do that. But as they were gearing up, Stefan began to slip back. He seemed to be less and less relevant. He wasn't recording much. So they really didn't have that.
They lost the momentum.
The momentum. But in the meantime, they brought Al Jackson back, who was really, at this point in time, working much more for High Records. People like Al Green, working over at that end. So he's now more or less not as an important part of what's happening at Stax, but they brought him over. And now that they had him, he and Duck started talking, and they have Bobby Manuel on guitar, and they're like, maybe we should just put together the MGs again with different players. I mean, okay, Booker's gone, so was Steve Cropper, but they have Bobby Manuel on guitar, and Carson Whitsett was around to play keyboards. And Carson got really excited about the idea because he was freaking out because these were his heroes. He was just, nothing could be better. I mean, in his own words, he just says, I learned more about music in 1 year, recording dynamics, expression, everything. Al Jackson taught me more than anybody ever thought about their concept of cutting hit records. Basically, what they were always after was a danceable rhythm. Al envisioned dancers while they played. His style sort of made you feel like you were floating when you were playing with him.
He's my
because
kind of
it
guy.
Was so free. He would do a roll or turn right in the middle of a phrase and you'd think he was not going to come out of this, but bam, he would be right on it. And you were set to go in the next section of the song. He taught me a lot about simplicity. It wasn't what you played. It was what you didn't play that counted. And that's true about the MGs across the board. The only thing that Whitsett was unhappy about was that when they formed, they really wanted to retain the sound of the MGs rather than go off in a new direction. So they tried to corral him in to basically play in a style that resembled Booker T rather than allowing him to basically do whatever he wanted. The idea at this point in time, 1973, wasn't really taking off, unfortunately. But the result of the song that they put together was pretty cool. So I think it's worth playing it right here. Here's the MGs then, without the Booker T and the part, with a song called Sugarcane. Thank you. cool reggaefied number there by the MGs called Sugarcane. Well, meanwhile, the other instrumental band that had pretty much taken over what the MGs had left vacant was grabbed by the Barkays. They became the band that was the new, you know, instrumental hotshots for the label around this point in time. And a lot of their material, the only thing they weren't happy about is they seemed to always get what was left over. People weren't writing things for them. They weren't being treated with the respect that they thought that they deserved. In fact, all of their singles around this time were originally intended for somebody else. Both this track and their previous hit were originally written for the Staple Singers, but they were rejected by the Staple Singers production team, which is how they ended up falling to the Barkays. So the Barkays took it, figured the song was good enough, but for their purpose, they wanted to funk it up a little bit. So they added a little bit of, you know, the Barkays touch. Usually what that meant was they added an instrumental breakdown in the middle to give it that live feel, where you get that exciting part in the middle that makes it feel like it's a live performance good. And where people would dance. So you're going to hear that on this track. Unfortunately, one that was not a hit for them. It's called It Ain't Easy. Knowledgeable musicologist, and you think that I just played some great lost Bill Withers track, I think you'd be forgiven, because that sounds so much like Bill Withers.
Yeah, it's it incredible. Does. Definitely got that.
And it's obviously deliberate, because this is what Stax was beginning to do around this time, was more or less resorting to try to basically cop popular styles. And Bill Withers was huge at this point in time, so it's only natural
Well, Motown made a living out of doing that.
Yeah, they did. But they were at their best when they weren't doing it. And,
true.
You know, the same thing here, I would say, follows in this instance. Now, the behind the scenes, which is crazy, he's behind the scenes because he owns the label. Mm-hmm. But the real, like, the secret hero of this entire series, really, is Jim Stewart, the man who started the label. He was basically the guy who quit his job at the bank and recruited his sister to get some money to help have him start this label. And he ended up being a white fiddle player who started a black R&B label in Memphis at a time when it was the most improbable thing for a guy with his background to have done.
Right.
And the amount of success that he had achieved was absolute, and just, you can't do anything but have super respect for the guy. And now that the label has become what it is, he feels like he's taking a back seat in what he himself has created, because
right.
It is now so black-centric in what it's about that he's essentially decided he's bowing out, because it's hard for him to feel as if he belongs. Well, here's what happens now. Again, reading directly from the book. And I'm going to be reading this in segments, so if there's awkward pauses, please don't blame it on the writer. The record company was deep in hock, joined recently by the publishing company. There was no mistaking that the debts were high. But Stax's outlook was promising. The European distribution deal would soon be up for renewal, and Stax intended to hike its license fee. Isaac Hayes' Two Tough Guys soundtrack was imminent, sure to be a smash, like all his albums were, maybe even bigger than Shaft, since he also starred in this movie. On its heels would be Isaac's soundtrack to the blaxploitation film Truck Turner. In the past 5 years, Isaac had released 5 albums that each did more than $2 million worth of business.
Wow.
The patterns indicated another welcome influx of money. Jim Stewart contemplated the company's position from his 56-acre private mansion. It was very quiet there. He'd come from the country, and the dense trees on his estate reminded him of his childhood in Middleton. But the house did not. He could have fit perhaps every house from his hometown into the vast complex that was now the Stewart home. The old Capitol Theater would fit inside, and all the Macklemore block he'd worked so hard to purchase. Jim, his wife, their 3 kids. It was like their own private country club. And it was quiet. Music had made him independently wealthy. He'd collected finally on the years of long hours and hard work. He'd enriched Atlantic. He'd enriched Gulf and Western and Deutsche Grammophon. He'd stayed 3 more years after his sister left, and the company had mushroomed in size and success. His break with Stax came when they were thriving, and it made both them and him wealthy. Al wanted total control of the Total Record Company, and he'd gotten it. And he'd received a swollen bank account, courtesy of Columbia Records, who'd also swelled Jim's account. Whatever shape the company was now in, Jim was not responsible for it. He did not need to help. Jim spent his money and time, both too plentiful, on jigsaw puzzles. Since leaving Stax, he was often at the family's expensive dining room table alone. He'd open a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle box, turn the pieces face up, separate the border pieces. Step by step, he'd assemble an image, a landscape perhaps, pastoral and distant, and that he'd never visit. Completing it, he'd throw the pieces back into the box and open a new one. Well, in February of 1974, unable to let go of the one great change he'd wrought upon the city and the world, Jim pledged more than everything he had to the bank.
Oh, my.
He gave Union Planters a personal guarantee against the company's loans, putting up all he held, including the millions he recently collected and all he was to receive. I reacted with my heart instead of my head, he told writer Rob Bauman. It was an emotional decision, not a prudent, sensible one. After making the pledge, Jim promptly put nearly $500,000 of his personal money into the company to help cover the operating costs. He was affirming his belief in the company's mission with his heart, his soul, and his wallet.
Oh, dear.
And his children's future. It was an epic move. Jim was a quiet man, conservative, and yet he'd been the One, to alter the course of history, to create in a racist and stratified society a space both inclusive and collaborative. He placed all of his chips on a single bet. He held nothing behind. No failsafe, no extra feathers, no spare $1 million. Jim could help, and he did. The following month, March, Stax took another sucker punch from Columbia. Due to the high number of records that Stax had delivered to Columbia, and with no discernible market need for more product, Columbia announced that it would begin withholding 40% of what it owed Stax to help cover the cost of returned product. Returns? The howl in Memphis could be heard in New York. Get the records to market. There won't be returns, and there will be more money for everybody if you'll just do the one thing that you're supposed to be good at. Get the product on the shelves. Though their relationship was really about one thing, distribution, Stax and Columbia could never get on the same page. From the beginning of the argument over who would control the branch distributors, record sales were dropping, Jim says. They couldn't agree on the basics of getting records to the stores. So many hours and days were spent trying to straighten these matters out, trying to get the philosophy and the people working together in concert, Jim sighs. It could never be accomplished. When the principals are involved in something extraneous of producing and marketing and promoting and selling records, which is your business, the inevitable occurs. Record sales start dropping. I'm not talking about a month or 2 months. This became continuous, and it got worse and worse, and a dichotomy was struck between the personalities involved, between our people and CBS's people. The problem became monumental, and the financial problems resulted from that.
Oh, dear.
What a shame. One track that never got to market, Little Milton, delivered a great song that could have been a hit. Never was. Here it is. It's called What It Is.
Oh, you got me so confused. And I tell you why, babe. Listen, when I think I'm doing the right thing, you say I'm doing wrong. When I wanna take you out, baby, you insist on staying at home. Oh, my heart is full of sorrow, and my eyes are full of tears. Oh, something is wrong with you, baby. Now tell me what it is. Lord, I give you all my paycheck, but you say it's not enough. Oh, baby, I work a lot of overtime, because times are kind of rough. Yes, they are. I can't seem to please you when I try to give you a thrill. Oh, something's wrong with you, baby. Please tell me what it is. Here's what I want to know. What it is that won't let me leave you alone? What it is that make me give up right or wrong? I know, baby, and you do too. It's because I'm in love with you. Oh, you say that I tomorrow. Oh, baby, you say it ended yesterday. Oh, that's a shame. I know you wanna leave me. Yes, you do. But you say you're gonna stay. Oh, baby, no matter how you treat me, oh, I love you still. So talk to me, baby, please now, and tell me what it is. Oh, baby, what it is that make me love you the way I do. Let me tell you what I'll do, what I'll do. Listen to what I'll do for you, baby. I'll climb the highest mountain, yes I will. I'll swim the deepest sea. Oh, I'll walk across the hot desert, yes I will. As long as I know you'll be waiting down for me. Oh, baby, one more thing. One more thing I'll do. I'll dive into the ocean, yes I will. Bring up a grain of sand. Oh baby, as long as I that I'll be your only man. Oh, baby, would you talk to me, baby? Please, please tell me, tell me. Ooh, tell me.
Honey, I just overheard what you were saying as that song was fading out. It's really, but all the thing is, like, with all this corporate bickering and what Columbia was sort of doing by having this stranglehold on Stax, so many innocent lives were affected and got screwed up because of this, by not allowing people to basically have the level of success that they could. That song by Little Milton could have been huge in 1973. It stalled at number 51 on the R&B charts.
Sad.
Never even saw it on the pop charts. Same thing for this next track, William Bell, one of my favorite singers at Stax, somebody who basically deserved the world. And he was at his peak around this time. This song stalled at number 54 on the R&B charts, which is to say it was hardly getting airplay anywhere. And the other thing is, it wasn't selling because it wasn't in the stores. You couldn't buy it if you wanted to. Here's William Bell with I've Got to Go On Without You. Irony intended, perhaps. About you, but I was listening to an awful lot of radio in 1973, an awful lot of pop radio, and that song easily could have been on the top 40. on the pop top 40.
Oh, yeah.
Easily, had it been heard. But the problem at this point, you could look at it two ways. Stax had too much material and not enough of it getting onto the charts. Or maybe there was a reason for that. Again, going back to the book, respect yourself. Quality, however, could have been seen as giving way to quantity. Between the start of 1973 and the end of 1974's first quarter, Stax played 9 singles on the R&B Top 10 and only 1 in the Pop Top 10. The label released, however, 74 singles. The output was multiplying the expenses and the hits were diminishing. We had less than 100, and all of a sudden, we had 200 on the payroll, says Jim, who was not the kind of boss to return and fire whole departments, even though his wealth was at stake. Columbia's lack of distribution was not, however, a figment of Stax's imagination. Stax's distributor in Memphis, in their own backyard, Hotline Records, was unable to get Stax product, quote, almost from the day the Columbia deal began, unquote, remembers one prominent employee. We couldn't buy records to distribute them. It was clear Columbia was trying to put Stax out of business. You'd hear the horror stories from the promotion guys about the inability to get Stax product into the marketplace, and we'd see our records sliding from the charts. As the distribution giant Unilateri revamped its deal in its own favor, Johnny Baylor, of all people, oh boy, stepped from his own morass to help. Now, Baylor, at this point in time, is being investigated intensely by the IRS for taking huge amounts of money. And the money that he took from Stax really was not doing anybody, especially poor Jim Stewart, doing anybody any favors. But he's going to try to help now. If Columbia's Jim Tyrell was in charge of getting records into the stores, as he indeed was, then surely he'd recognize a demand from Johnny Baylor that Mr. Tyrell do his job. We had become very close to Al, says Dino. That's the guy who worked for Johnny, one of Johnny's henchmen.
Oh, boy.
Johnny was angry that CBS Records was ripping Stax off. They wasn't putting the records out properly. I really felt that they wanted to kill Stax Records because of the challenge to them. I thought that CBS just did the thing on them. So, Johnny had a brief, charged conversation with Mr. Tyrell.
Oh, boy.
Johnny Baylor made a threat to Mr. Tyrell, says Logan Westbrooks. Follow Al's dictates or else.
Oh, boy.
And Jim Tyrell was not intimidated. He came from the streets. He stared it right in the face. So that was the beginning of that little dispute. That little dispute quickly attained great size. In April, while Stax was down, Columbia hit them again. In light of this backlog of stock that Stax refused to acknowledge, Columbia was going to keep the $1.3 million it owed Stax. Stax's quarterly payroll in March 1974 was over $500,000, well over $2 million per year. Al attacked the problem. He hired his brother Paul away from General Electric, where he was a vice president, to head a new department of new hires at Stax, retail relations. My brother staffed up a division doing nothing but calling retailers, so we were able to document for CBS this store, this person, this is the product that they ordered. You didn't ship it. CBS denied it, said it was all lies in face of hard evidence that was being presented to them. Meanwhile, Johnny Taylor has his own tale to sing of about finances, perhaps on a smaller scale. It's called Cheaper to Keeper.
It's a good song.
If you're tied up, you better stay tied up, because it's cheaper to keep her. This is from T. It says, it's cheaper to keep her. It's cheaper to keep her. When your little girl make you mad, and you get an attitude and pack your bags, 5 little children that you're leaving behind, son, you're gonna pay some alimony or do some time. That's why it's cheaper to keep her. Help me say it, y'all. It's cheaper to keep her.
It's cheaper to keep her.
See, when you get through staring that judge in the face, You're gonna wanna cuss the whole human race. That's why it's cheaper to keep her.
It's cheaper to keep her. It's cheaper to keep her.
$2 to bring the little girl home.
Ooh.
Now you're about to pay $2,000 to leave her alone.
Ooh.
You see another woman out there and you wanna make a change.
Ooh.
But she ain't gonna want you cause you won't have a damn thing.
Yeah, yeah,
that's why it's cheaper to keep her. Everybody sing along with me. It's cheaper to keep her.
It's cheaper to keep her.
By the time you get through looking at the judge in the face, gonna wanna cuss the whole human race.
Yeah, yeah,
that's why
yeah,
it's cheaper
yeah.
to keep her.
It's cheaper to keep her.
It's cheaper to keep her. Mama's pocketbook.
Yeah, yeah,
that's why
yeah,
it's cheaper to keep her.
It's cheaper to keep her.
It costs too much to leave her alone. Yeah.
It's cheaper to keep her.
I know it's cheaper to keep her. Yeah.
It's cheaper to keep her.
Cause you gon' pay some alimony if you leave home.
It's cheaper to keep her.
I tell y'all, it's cheaper to keep her. All the fellas out there know what I'm talking about. Don't you know that it's cheaper to stay at home?
Her.
I gotta tell you, I'm bringing you the message tonight.
It's cheaper.
It's cheaper to cheaper, keep. Cheaper to
cheaper,
keep. Cheaper to
it's keep. Cheaper to keep.
Cheaper to keep. She gon' cost you too much if you let her go, man. It's cheaper to keep her.
It's cheaper. It's cheaper.
You might as well put up with your little
it's cheaper
arguments
to
and fuss
keep
and fight.
Her.
Let's go. I'm gonna tell you something tonight. I tell you, it's cheaper,
cheaper to keep her.
It's cheaper.
It's cheaper.
Amen.
It's cheaper.
Ain't it cheaper,
it's
cheaper, cheaper to keep her? Yeah.
It's cheaper.
By the time you get through looking that judge in the face.
Right.
A solid advice song.
Cheaper to keep her. Now, if we were talking about all the problems, of course, there's to every rule, there's an exception. And with all the problems and the things that Stax was having and all this great material that wasn't hitting the charts, there's one artist that did manage to get onto the pop charts, have one of their biggest hits. Although, for some reason, this song is not as well remembered as their other hits. And when you think of the Staple Singers, I'm sure you think of I'll Take You There and Respect Yourself.
Of course.
I don't know why this song is not mentioned in the exact same breath. It's called If You're Ready, Come Go With Me. And it's a song that they almost didn't record.
Huh.
First thing that happened is when Mavis heard it, she said, you know what? It's too much like I'll Take You There. And she argued against doing it, saying that we don't need to do that. We're good enough. You know, look at us. We're the ones that get the hits. We don't need to do that. And it was her dad who says, you know what? If you find something that's that good and stick with it, what's so bad about that? What do you think James Brown does? What about Curtis Mayfield? They do it.
Good point, Pop.
Just right. And on top of that, the fact was this song actually had a serious structure where I'll Take You There was more of a loose groove. After the first verse, there was nothing but Mavis ad-libbing her way to the end of the record. So in that sense, to me, this song should definitely exist in the top three Staple Singers of old. And that's saying something when I say that, because I'm a huge Staple Singers. I love that this track we started the show off with, one of my favorite songs, but this, absolutely up there with those two biggest hits. It might even be the peak of their career. It's called If You're Ready, Come Go With Me.
Come go with me.
Mm-mm-mm. Such a beautiful song there by the Staple Singers. Love that track. I just don't hear it enough. And I would expect that I would have been hearing that as often as some of their other hits, but there it is, called
Rich.
If You're Ready, Come Go With Me. Now, meanwhile, the thing you could say about the Staples that really made them special, if you think about it, is they were about as poised as a high wire act. They walked that tightrope, perfectly balanced on the fence between pop music and gospel.
Oh, yeah.
It's so precarious. If you think about it, can you think of another pop act that you could say is equal parts gospel and pop?
No, not even Ray Charles.
Right, but I mean really walking that so that you could walk into a gospel tent and perform gospel
right.
music with your pop material.
Right.
There's really nobody I can think of. Your pop or your gospel, or you were one and you became the other.
Right.
The Sam Cooke thing, the Ray Charles thing.
Absolutely.
But to do both and stay on that tightrope, it's
right.
a phenomenally difficult place to be. And that's sort of like what hurt this next act, they're called The Emotions. They were obviously a bunch of girls trying to be a pop act and struggling at that. And with this next song, they recorded a beautiful gospel song, and it essentially ruined their career. This was the end of it for them. So, and basically, it didn't help Stax any either. But it's a great song that we can to end our show with, by The Emotions. And of course, we'll be back next week to continue this series and to do our Wednesday show as well. Of course, folks. Hope you enjoyed this. See you then. Enjoy your weekend. Meanwhile, we'll leave you with this great gospel tune by The Emotions called "Peace Be Still."
WHPC 90.3.